Thanks for attending session 166, titled Sex Abuse and Resources, What Options Are Available for Victims. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. And we encourage you to also purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within that framework. A little bit about this presentation. Whiteley will speak to the current state of sexual abuse within the LDS Church, and a brief presentation will be made regarding the current systems put in place by the church to support survivors, and also how these systems can be problematic at times. The presenter will review how to access resources that help survivors, and the presentation will include a question and answer period. Dr. Amber Cherubi Whiteley has her PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Utah. She conducted her dissertation on the healing processes of Latter-day Saint sexual abuse survivors. Amber's research interests center around social justice issues. Amber is interested in research that supports the Latter-day LDS Mormon ex-Mormon community and helps the community move towards well-being and healing from healing from trauma. Her past research topics have involved women's issues, religious, sexual, and gender diverse issues, multicultural counseling, and childhood sexual abuse. She is currently completing her doctoral internship at the University of Utah Counseling Center, although I believe you just finished it. Yeah, so we'll turn the time over to Amber.
I have to speak into this so it's being recorded.
Cool. And we can pass around this mic for comments and questions and things like that.
Yeah, so. Okay. I probably won't do that. So you're all probably coming in here wondering why I set up this circle here, and everyone feel free to join or not to join. It's like a common thing for therapists to enjoy circles of groups of people to, especially at conferences even. And so I wanted to... A little bit of background is that Lindsay had asked me to give a presentation like this because I know that she gets quite a few questions from survivors in the community. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Around people kind of sharing their stories of having been assaulted or abused and looking for resources. Me kind of having done my research in this and being a therapist myself, I wanted to kind of give a presentation around like what resources are available, but I also am never quite aware of what people might already know or what would be helpful, especially me kind of being enmeshed in it all the time. I can forget the things that I know that other people don't know. So I'd love if we could kind of start with what kind of brought you here to this presentation, what you're interested in learning more about, so that I can kind of focus my presentation around things that you specifically want to know about. And we can kind of start. I won't have us pass around the mic for this, because if you don't want to be recorded, that's totally fine. And what I'll just do is make sure that I give the information into the mic so that the information itself is recorded, if that sounds good to everyone. Okay. Why don't we go this direction in the circle, if that sounds okay. And if you don't have anything that you're interested in, that's okay. We've got the right to speak, right to pass, which means that there's no judgment either way in either having a question or not having a question. I also want to, just before we go, and I realize I already put you on the spot, so I apologize, but before we kind of start this, I wanted to just make a mention that I recognize that when it comes to abuse and assault, that this can kind of be a presentation that can oftentimes be triggering. And just given open permission to everyone to feel free at any point in time to do what you need to do to take care of yourself, whether that's to leave the presentation because you need to go to the bathroom or because you're feeling overwhelmed by the presentation. We won't assume one way or another, but feel free to just take care of yourself in whatever way you need to. So go ahead. Why don't we start this way, and you can kind of share as much or as little you want to pass.
Perfect. There are a couple of issues that concern me about the LDS Church in particular. Mm-hmm. As a recovering Catholic, I've watched with great interest the growing groundswell against the abuse that occurred systematically in the Catholic Church over years and years and years, and the actions that have been taken to rectify that situation. I'm concerned that we have a ticking time bomb in the church, and I think we're starting to see that emerge, and so I'm hoping especially since I live in an area where the church is not by any means the majority. I guess hoping for some insight.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Personally, I have had an issue with sexual abuse.
Sure.
I have a lot of people around me.
Yeah.
And outside the church. And that sense of
kind of how you can support those around you.
Exactly.
Perfect. We can definitely go over that.
I admin a number of Facebook groups for parents with LGBTQ children, and LGBTQ children are at higher risk.
They are, yeah.
And some of the parents in the group, too, talk about past abuse. So I'm here to learn so that I can better serve people as they're in those groups.
Perfect. Okay, sounds good.
I'm curious about one kind of comparative issue. When a woman comes to a, say, like a BYU standards officer,
mm-hmm.
or a other university or college comparable position, how many of those that you have interviewed have been confronted by the accusation or the question of their truthfulness, their lying?
Oh,
and
sure.
And I'm wondering if there's a comparison. You might not have the other side of the comparison, but I'm wondering with women who report or children who report abuse to a church leader, LDS church leader, how many are confronted with the question, are you telling me the truth?
Mm.
And compared to Catholic or Protestant
mm-hmm.
leaders who might respond that way to a woman who or a young girl who is making that plea and that claim.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was interested.
Kind of interested in, yeah. I think that's a really interesting area of research that hasn't gone into yet that there really should be. When it comes to, I'm going to go ahead and put this down.
Sorry, Sunstone. When it kind of comes to, those are called, the name is like escaping me right now, but when you look into specifically like the percentages of like, and comparing percentages of like how often does something happen, those studies can be really hard to do, especially because they're often self-report. And so finding even statistics on how often sexual abuse happens within the church is non-existent right now, because it's hard to get numbers that we're even sure of that even within the United States, looking at like how often does this happen with our own kids just comparatively in the United States. And so I think those are really interesting questions. And I can kind of speak to, actually, if you come to my presentation tomorrow on the dissertation data, I can speak a little bit more to what people I've interviewed have kind of reported has been their experience and being questioned about whether the truthfulness of their experiences, for sure.
I don't have personal experience myself, fortunately, with that, but many people I have loved through the years and still do, and many people have had experience both in LGBTQ or in cis situations, and a lot of it hasn't necessarily, I don't know the details of some of the things that happened, but to the reaction from, say, BYU or from the church at all.
For sure.
And I'm just, as I'm becoming more aware of different things, I want to know both to be able to be more compassionate myself and also to face a lot of my friends that are still half in, half out in the church and stuff, or they're all in. Their disbelief that any of this has ever happened, and then on the other hand, what people are exploiting things. So mm-hmm. I just want to know more.
Sure. Yeah, I think those are all interesting points. So.
I just want to learn more.
Yeah.
One of my relatives was a pedophile,
mm-hmm.
and so it's really emotionally affecting my family.
For sure.
Without getting too revealing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really affected it deeply, mm-hmm. and so I just want to learn everything I can about it, and I want to know what happened, why it happened.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's really hard to have it like impacted within your family having a known abuser. That's got to be hard on multiple levels.
Yeah, it happened a couple of generations ago, but it's still affecting
sure the intergenerational trauma all the way
down. Yeah, it's still here.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. I'm going to stand, but don't feel like I'm looking down.
Okay. Well, my name is Christy Johnson. I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And we just released our documentary for premiere called No Crime and Sin. But being on the inside of the church, we experienced cover-up on all levels in multiple states, all the way up to the prophet's office. So we know what the cover-up looks like.
Right.
I also know what it's like to sit across from leaders and try to, you know, tell them what's going on and not be believed. So I'm so interested, though. I did leave the church, but that had nothing to do with what happened to us. But I am so interested in what the church is doing. And from your guys' point of view, because I have called on President Nelson to make policy changes about reporting directly to law enforcement. And so I'm so open to hear what you have to say. I'm really actually excited to hear it. So.
Cool. I'm glad you're here.
I'm interested in, as a student at BYU, I had my own Me Too movement and didn't even think it was something that I could report. I mean, he was a priesthood leader and he was a professor and, you know, and I'm only just now getting around to writing about it and find that I'm not believed by critique partners, by editors, I'm here to learn how, it's so fascinating to me that it's in so many different any power system, you know. It's in when I wanted to go into the field of study that I wanted to go into, you know, and that was sort of the doorway into. It's you know, and it's just pervasive. As we every day we find some. Anyway,
yeah,
that's what I'm.
It is. I completely agree with you. It's pervasive, and it especially happens in power systems. Like we're not unique in having sexual abuse within the LDS Church, which is the both comforting and really unfortunate thing in a lot of ways. For those of you who walked in later, I was explaining that. I'm a therapist, and so I like group circles. I also like for presentations to feel like I'm not talking at people and to kind of make sure that I'm making the presentation feel applicable. So if you feel so, if you'd like to, you can come and join our circle. If you'd like to hang back, that's quite all right, too. What I'm going to go ahead and do, though, is I created a handout on just some basic resources, and I'm going to hand this out to, I'll hand this to you, Paula. Paula is going to come around and hand out this resources handout, and I'm just going to kind of go through, I think the information that I included in here is kind of like a basic template for some of the resources. A lot of this might be stuff that people are already really familiar with. Some of it might be completely new information. And I'm going to kind of go through in a little bit more detail each of the sections, but please feel free to raise your hand, ask any questions, and let's make this more of like a discussion format, essentially. And if you'd like to come join, feel free, come on up. Let me start with therapy. So I include a whole section here on therapy because I find that it's hard for even myself as a therapist to find a good therapist at times. I don't think that our system for mental health referrals is easy to navigate by any means. In some ways, insurance companies will intentionally make it really hard to be able to receive therapy. In fact, some insurance companies are known for not including up-to-date information about their therapist so that they won't have to pay for therapy through your coverage. Yeah, really, like, new thing that's happening, if anyone has Select Health in here, I apologize to you because Select Health is really known for having therapists who will have 6-month waiting list, never opening up their insurance panels to have new therapists join them, specifically so that the insurance company will assume that you just get better in that 6 months instead of having to wait and actually get the therapy that you need. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, how do we find therapy with all that that's going on? So specifically for sexual assault and sexual abuse survivors, you want to find a therapist who has trauma training. So two examples of that are EMDR and exposure therapy. But that's not the only forms of trauma training that you can have. In the state of Utah, you can have sexual assault training. And in fact, if you go through a 40-hour training process, then you can be called a sexual assault counselor. That's specific to the state of Utah, but it's also a national program that happens to exist. Although not a lot of therapists go through it, you can still get really good trauma training without having gone through that 40-hour training. You're going to know by some of the language that the therapists use that's trauma-focused, that doesn't use victim-blaming language. Yeah, go ahead.
What is EMDR?
Great question. And I always get this wrong. But it's eye movement desensitization, and I forget what the R is. You remember?
Reflex?
Hmm?
Reflex?
No, it's not reflex. Yeah.
Reprocessing.
Yes, yes. Reprocessing. Thank you. It is essentially, so I'm going to, okay, here's going to come some of my biases. EMDR is incredibly useful, and it kind of works because it's similar to exposure therapy, because it involves the process of being able to retell your story multiple times. And this is true with any personal work when it comes to trauma work, is that the more that you can get, do stuff that's similar to exposure therapy, the more you can get to a place where you feel safe being able to reprocess through your trauma and being able to basically rewire your brain in thinking about past traumatic events into being able to reframe to yourself, I am now safe and I am now okay. You are going to be able to turn off some of the anxiety or depression ways in which your brain has been trained. And I can kind of go into a little bit of like the neuroscience behind it, which is that when we go through trauma, right, we have what's called our reptilian brain, and I always do this little image because we've got like our whole brain up here, and in the middle is our reptilian brain, and that's where our amygdala is, and that's where trauma processing happens because we go into the fight, flight, or freeze responses whenever we have something traumatic. And essentially our body takes over and goes into survival mode and says, something overwhelming is happening here. I'm going to take over for you and make sure that you survive whatever this is. And in the past, this worked really well when we were like running away from literal tigers or saber-toothed tigers, et cetera, bears. Now we have that kind of response to even things that aren't necessarily saber-toothed tigers. But can happen, especially when it comes to sexual abuse, sexual assault. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is that, and some of the books that I mentioned in here go into a lot more detail about what that process kind of looks like and the neuroscience behind it. But in any of this work, what you're doing is trying to reprocess things so that when you re-experience or have memories of these events come up, your body doesn't become reactivated in the same way it was before, where you're experiencing the same fight or flight response, even though you're not being chased by, or not actually physically re-experiencing the sexual abuse and sexual assault. So, I'm kind of jumping all over the place. Feel free to stop me and ask me if you have any questions. Let's go back to finding a good therapist. So, someone who has trauma training, that might be EMDR, it might be exposure therapy, it might be someone who does really great CBT and that they're really used to, that they have CBT experience that is in a trauma-informed way. You want any therapist who is able to say that they have trauma-informed training. And it doesn't have to necessarily be EMDR or exposure therapy. In fact, what the research kind of shows when it comes to any therapeutic experience is that as long as you feel connected to your counselor and you agree on the goals that you're working on, that you're going to have better therapy outcomes. which I think is a big misconception a lot of people have. We think of it in terms of whether the therapist is implementing the right therapeutic intervention, and that's not always necessarily true. It's more about how connected you feel with your counselor and whether you feel like they're doing a good job of what they're doing, which makes sense, right? We're not going to trust, we're not going to go and do the deep personal work unless we actually feel like we agree with what our therapist is wanting us to do. So, sorry, you had your hand raised there for a second.
Yeah, no, I was wondering if when someone goes through this training, do they get a certificate they can put on the wall?
Not always. So,
yeah. Can you repeat the questions and what they're saying before? Just for the people in the back, because your voice projects. Yeah, thanks.
Sorry, the question was whether you go through this training, you can get a certificate on your wall so that, I'm guessing, when a therapist or a patient walks in, then you can be able to look at, oh, okay, this person checked. No, unfortunately. So for myself, I got my PhD from the University of Utah, and I got to choose whether I had a special proficiency in any area I wanted, and I chose trauma therapy as my special proficiency. However, I would have a lot of therapists from my program who didn't get a special proficiency in trauma training, who I would still recommend, who got incredible experience by going to the VA and doing a practicum and working with PTSD veterans. So it's really, I think it's important to ask about what is your training experience, what kinds of trainings have you been through. So you could go to a program that maybe doesn't have a ton of trauma training, like right now, right? I have done my 5 years, my PhD, but if I wanted to, I could go out and get a lot more training and continuing education classes. I'm not currently EMDR certified. I'm going to become EMDR certified. Thank you. Sorry. So it's really more asking those kinds of questions, like what makes you think, and there are ethical like codes for therapists that you should not be providing treatment to clients outside of your own area of expertise. And it's also really important, as we said, like with research outcomes, for you to feel like you're able to be connected to your therapist. In fact, so one of the things, let's get down to the bullet point about psychologytoday.com. That might sound like a really basic tool to be able to find a therapist, but I find it's like really essential when I'm helping my own clients find a therapist. So when you go to Psychology Today, there's a search tool, and you can search for someone who accepts your insurance, and then you can also search for someone who has experience with trauma counseling. And then you can read bios of those who are still there and just kind of see the person that from their bio, like, I feel connected to this person. In some ways, it's almost like a dating website for therapists. And I find it's really effective because when you find someone, you know, I put up my own little bio and I say, here's like my philosophy on therapy, which isn't everyone's philosophy on therapy. Like, I'm sure not everyone in this room loves that I have like a circle and I'm like giving a presentation in this way. That's okay. Everyone has different personality styles. Same with therapists. You're going to find one that you connect with more than others. That's great. You want to find the one out there that you feel really connected to.
I have a question. Yeah. How long does that take? You have to go to like 5 therapists, or do most people connect on the first time? How extensive?
No, please, go ahead. You can. That's a really great point. Thanks for bringing this up. So some but not all therapists will allow you to do a phone consultation, and you should ask for that. So you can call up a therapist and say, hey, I read your bio on Psychology Today, or I saw, you know, your website. I'm interested in becoming a client. Are you accepting new clients? Can we chat on the phone for an initial consultation? They should be able to say yes. Sometimes therapists will charge, but like it'll be a minimum amount of like say $15 to $30 for that initial consultation. And it should be a way for you to kind of interview the therapist and the therapist to kind of interview you to make sure that it's a mutual fit for both of you.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Kind of going back to your initial question, I hope it doesn't take 5 therapists, but I have noticed like I think at the most it's like 2 to 3, and hopefully you're able to kind of do that initial consultation so you're not just like starting up with a new therapist you know, dispelling all your secrets and then moving on to another one. That would be jarring. That wouldn't feel appropriate or, like, helpful or therapeutic. So I do think that, like, the research side of things becomes really important, making sure that that doesn't happen.
Can I ask a question about Psychology Today?
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll look up therapists there, and, like, when it comes to, like, their specializations, which is, like, over on, like, the right, mm-hmm. it's like they have 10 or 15 listed.
Yes.
And so, like, should that... I kind of feel like, to me, that's kind of like a red flag. It's like, well, really, what do you, are you just trying to get in clients, or, I don't know. So what do I don't know, how, what are your feelings about that? What should I really look for?
That's good. Or? That was a bullet point I meant to include on here. It is a red flag if someone says that they work with everything possible. It kind of means that they're trying to get as many clients in through the door. Not everyone can, there is no way possible that you can have that much experience that you can adequately see all of the different, and that's why there are things such as special proficiencies, right? So I think it becomes really clear when you're looking at these Psychology Today profiles. Sorry, I'm like trying to balance those. making sure that it makes sense. And I think, like, as you're reading through these profiles, some of them will make sense and some of them will be like, what? No. So, good question.
Oh, my other question is, like, when... Like, psychologist versus psychiatrist, when should someone... Oh, you want mama? Is that the problem? Or you just not want me talking? Okay. Psychologist versus... Oh, did I just spill the entire thing? Okay. I'm a wreck, clearly. Psychologist versus psychiatrist. So if I am trying to find a person to see me, like, should I be looking for both, like a therapist and a psychiatrist? To kind of double team my medical slash whatever care, or like what?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
So if you're considering, if you're thinking that medication is something that you're interested in, I'm gonna give like a, I'm gonna try to shorten my answer. No, I'm not. I'm really bad at this. We are currently kind of in a prescribing crisis in our country. We have very few people with actual openings who are adequately able to prescribe medications the way that they should be able to. What I'm talking about that is that typically when you look up a psychiatrist will have like a 6-month waiting list. And psychiatrists are some of the only people who have the training in both in actual psychotropic medications and understand all the nuances between all of the different medications. Sometimes what is happening for myself is that clients will go to their primary care physician and they'll prescribe, oh yeah, you're depressed. Here's like a basic SSRI, meaning like Prozac is a common example of an SSRI, and not really have a really great understanding of like even the differences between SSRIs or benzodiazepines. And so you really want to find someone who has that like medical experience of specifically psychotropic medications. I personally really love psych nurses, APRNs. They are incredible prescribers who have a great amount of experience and understanding of psychotropic medications. And so what I will often find, what I will try to find for my clients who are interested in both medications and therapy is a group private practice where there is a psych APRN as well as a therapist, so that the therapist and the psych APRN can kind of work together and collaborate treatment in that way. Same goes if there's like a psychiatrist in a group private practice, although that is a little bit more rare these days. Oftentimes psychiatrists will have their own private practice where they provide both therapy and medications. I'm just a big fan of psych APRNs because they tend to be more client-centered. They're kind of trained with this, as I think most nurse practitioners are, to be really client-focused and to kind of integrate what clients are coming in and talking about is important to them in their own medical history. So, okay. Yeah, I think I answered that. Any other questions about that? Yeah.
Are there any practices that have, like, the APRNs and, like, say, a clinical social worker therapy, and then...
Yes, and this is a great question. So, like, what are the differences with all the titles, right? This may be what you're trying to get at, but...
Kind of, yeah.
And if not, I feel like it's something I should talk about anyway.
Okay.
So, I will go in, I'm a psychologist, which means, well, I'm not quite yet a psychologist because I'm not licensed. I'm not legally allowed to call myself a psychologist until I'm licensed, but I have my PhD in psychology, which means that I will someday be a licensed psychologist. Psychologists are the ones who get their doctorates in specifically psychology, which means that we have 5 years of experience and training. And we also get a lot of training and research as well. And so we kind of get this like specific niche thing that we'll end up focusing in on, which for me happens to be LAS, sexual abuse workers, yes. Above, well, not above that, but what we often get confused with are psychiatrists. Psychiatrists are prescribing doctors, so people who went to medical school, who decided after going through medical school that they were most interested in the field of psychiatry and wanted to be able to prescribe medicine. They can do therapy as well. However, you should also know that they only have 1 year experience of being able to, of getting counseling experience. And so oftentimes they will get, after they've graduated, a lot more experience in counseling after they've gone on to graduate. I've known some psychiatrists who are amazing in therapy. Other times I've known psychiatrists who are really great at prescribing and not so great at counseling, and they would let other people kind of do the counseling side of things. This is all more just information. And when I say this about any of the different people, I think that any of the different therapists can go on to get the kind of experience they need to become incredible therapists, incredible if they have the capacity for prescribers. But it's good to know the differences between all the different fields so that when you're looking for a therapist, you can kind of know the background of what the training is about. So then there's three different kinds of master's level clinicians. There are clinical social workers, which you'll see as LCSWs if they're licensed, or CSWs if they're not licensed and working towards licensure. There are CMHCs, which stands for clinical mental health counselors, which then become LPCs when they're licensed. And then there's marriage and family therapists, so that's MFTs, and then they become LMFTs if they're licensed. That means that they've all had 2 years of experience. With social work, there's going to be more of an integration around looking at areas of social justice, although I think that there's a good balance of social justice for the clinical mental health counselors that I've seen as well. Clinical mental health counselors, might have a little bit more experience with diagnosis, not always, but sometimes. And then MFTs are going to have more of like a family therapy or even a marriage counseling focus. And with all of that, anyone could go off and kind of have their own experience with marriage or family therapy as well. And then, let's see, is there another area that I'm forgetting?
MSW.
Well, yes, thank you, that's clinical social workers. So MSW stands for Masters in Social Work, and so then they become clinical social workers or LCSWs. Thank you.
And none of them can prescribe, right?
Right. So out of that, the only people who can prescribe are psychiatrists or APRNs, yes, or general practitioners. However, there are some states that are now working towards, since we're having this prescribing kind of crisis, we have some states that are actually working towards being able to get clinicians to be able to prescribe if they go on to get an extra master's level in just prescribing psychotropic medication.
Okay. The area of Washington where I live has a real shortage of, and my husband and son have a lot of issues trying to find.
Yeah, Oregon, Washington, and California have all been working towards trying to get the legislature to pass that. It's available in 5 states right now, and it seems like more people are thinking that that's the direction the field is going to go in the future, but there's a lot of pushback in the legislature, as you can imagine. So.
Well, thank you.
That's, like I said, it's my little area rant. Okay, so I have here, consider LDS family services or a community therapist that the bishop can contract to pay, because if you are active within your ward, sometimes a bishop will pay for someone that you are already in contact with. And when I say that, I give this big caveat here. Make sure they have trauma experience and act directly about limits of confidentiality. So I've heard quite a few stories, as you can imagine, of therapist who, especially in LDS family services, who didn't have trauma training, who would blame their clients for their own sexual abuse, who had their clients sign a waiver saying that they could directly talk with the bishop about everything that was discussed in therapy, which kind of goes against some of the basic ethical principles within our field of that therapy sessions should be confidential and that they should do no harm. So, and I think that if you're active within a ward and you can have your bishop pay for therapy, like, why not, you know? So I think that if you are here and you're active in your ward and that's something you want to pursue, I think it's something that is worth having a conversation about, as long as you can look at the person that you're wanting to go have therapy from has good trauma training, and that they're not going to have you sign a waiver of confidentiality with your bishop. Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard things about when the bishop signs a counselor.
Yeah.
There's some things from pointing out to this sort of thing. And, it goes back to my ear of it. If young girl was pregnant, the baby for adoption and that sort of thing. It's like, we want you to do this, and it's extended in psychology as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of what you heard as well, or not?
I mean, the biggest thing I've heard is just bishops having direct conversations with therapists, especially therapists at LDS Family Services, that would then make therapists kind of focus in their therapy and on something that wasn't important or was damaging to a client or insinuated to a client that they were at fault for their sexual abuse or needed to repent for something which isn't therapy at that point. And so that's why, like, I both include this, but with a really big caveat. Like, yeah, I think it would be great if the church, in fact, I have my own experience of when I was in high school, I was already in contact with a psychologist and the bishop had paid for my counseling sessions as a sexual abuse survivor with a psychologist and I didn't sign a waiver. So, like, I've had other, talked with other sexual abuse survivors who have said that they've had good experiences of being able to have the church pay for their counseling sessions. So there's a part of me that's like, if you can have that happen, like, awesome. Like, let's use that as a resource. But there has to be, like, clear limits here around make sure the therapist is trauma-informed, that it's someone you have a say in being able to pick, and that it's someone who isn't going to make you sign a waiver of confidentiality.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do know from personal experience that the LDS Social Services, it is a requirement.
Right.
When they send you over to their counselors. Because I was signing papers and came up upon that one. And I asked them what it was. And they said, in order to get counseling here, you have to sign a waiver where the therapist can talk to your bishop and keep him informed about what you're talking about.
Right.
Which to me is so violating anyway.
Absolutely.
But then if the church is going to pay it all, they expect to get information from therapists. So that confidentiality thing, you have to be very careful.
Absolutely.
That you do not sign that. And even though you don't sign it, you have to make sure your therapist is not talking to the bishop.
Agreed. I will say that 9 times out of 10, I have heard from people who have had negative experiences with LDS Family Services, and I have heard of 1 out of 10 who has had a really positive experience with LDS Family Services, where they had a therapist who, even though they had signed the confidentiality clause, didn't really report on things that were necessary to the bishop, would report on things around like how their spirituality was doing and be like, yeah, things are going, you know, in that direction. I think that those therapists in LDS Family Services are rare, for sure. And I think that it's a dangerous game. And I say that knowing that there are like the rare few who have had good experiences with it. And that's not to negate the 90% of people that I've talked to who have had really negative experiences with it either.
Well, I'm sure they have. You know, I had a really good therapist. Mm-hmm. The LDS Social Services, but what was offensive was that they were able to communicate with my bishop.
Yeah.
That should be the bishop he should have nothing to do with anything.
Sure, yeah.
And so they're great therapists. I'm not saying that they're not, but I just, that waiver should not even exist.
I agree.
Even if they're paying for it.
Yeah.
They don't have a right to know anything.
I completely agree.
If they want to know about your spirituality, then bring in for a bishop's seminary.
My insurance company knows about what I've got, but is paying for it, but they don't know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Why should my bishop?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I just wanted to point that out. Like, no, they have good therapists. I had a wonderful one.
That's good.
So it's not a reflection on the therapist. It's just the church's
the policy. I agree. Yeah, it is a problem. It's something I've had a hard time understanding how ethically it's even able to exist.
Yeah,
exactly. That's because it's unethical.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'll just say it.
No, I agree. Yeah.
Do you feel like it's improving at all, or is it?
I think that there have been quite a few things that the church is starting to become aware of that are liabilities that they're making moves towards, but I also see the church digging in their heels in some ways, the more criticism that they're getting as well. So I think that there are some, and this is true, right? Whenever we see any like area of change within the church, we see like some people in the right positions able to make the right movement, and then we see other people digging in their heels, yes, and backtracking. That's what I've kind of seen over the last 5 years. So, yeah.
Can you just clarify? So you're saying that 90% of people that are in the services have bad experience?
That's in my experience of having talked with.
So what kind of training do they have?
That's a great question. I mean, anyone who works at LDS Family Services, typically I've seen more master's level clinicians at LDS Family Services. I'm not entirely sure why that is. I think that master's level clinicians can be incredible therapists, but they do have to be active members of the church. And so I do think that sometimes there can be a bias of being able to buy within the system and then reporting back to the system. That makes me wonder about when you're a therapist working within a system, if you're not questioning the system itself, that you can inadvertently not be aware of your own biases that could be potentially causing harm. And I think that's true of any system. For myself, I have to think through what my own inner biases are with any of my identities that I hold so that I'm not causing harm with any of my clients. But I often find especially that there are clients who get referred to LDS Family Services who then receive a therapist who isn't trauma-informed, who does victim blaming. So like when I talk about trauma-informed language, that's any language that isn't going to be victim blaming, that is going to reaffirm to a survivor that they didn't have, that they didn't choose to be abused, that they had the right to be able to exist and have not experienced assault and not experienced abuse, no matter what the circumstances were of their abuse or their assault. And I have heard more experiences where therapists at LDS Family Services did not assert that, which is unfortunate.
So you're saying consider that.
Absolutely, yeah. And I say that knowing that, that there's, for some people, that might be your only option, right? Like, that's why I put this in here. I'm not saying it's ideal. I'm really not. You know, I recognize that this system, that it should never be within any therapist to be able to report to anyone about what's going on in therapy. That's like a basic tenet of.
Can I get you a license for doing that?
You absolutely can, unless you have a client sign away their rights to it. Right. And so, and I include it because I recognize that for, you know, these small rural towns in Utah where maybe the only therapist group in town is LDS Family Services, or you don't have insurance and the church is willing to pay for it if you go to LDS Family Services, that this could be something that there could be some good that comes from it, even under kind of shitty circumstances.
It's a technical term.
Yes. It's under my contract shooting circumstances, yes.
Funny culture.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks,
Anne. Yeah. No problem. Okay, so personal work. So I include some books in here. So again, like
with all of this, I'm just trying to think of, like, what are some areas that can be helpful, even if you don't have, so let's say that you don't have even availability, or you have availability to LDS Family Services, but you're not willing to, like, be able to go through the shitty circumstances of being able to sign away your rights to confidential therapy. There's a lot of great personal work that can be done, and I think that oftentimes clients end up doing this work on their own, and it can be really triggering. And so I include all this kind of knowing that, like, everyone I meet with, that everyone here in this audience and any one of my clients are capable of being able to cultivate their own personal work and their own inner resilience. And that here are some of the tools to be able to do so. So these are like the Bible trauma therapy books that I think are really helpful that I'll recommend to my clients. Courage to Heal, Body Keeps the Score, Waking the Tiger, and Betrayal Trauma. I can mention a little bit about each one of them. Courage to Heal is kind of like a fundamental feminist book that came out that kind of like introduced what is assault and like what would it mean to heal from that, and kind of taking it into your own, taking back your own power to be able to heal from trauma. Body Keeps the Score is an amazing book by a psychiatrist who goes into all the details of how trauma is stored within the body and why when we have these traumatic memories come up, why we have physical bodily reactions as when we experience our trauma. Waking the Tiger is similar, but goes into more of the neuropsychology of everything, and is really interesting as well. And Betrayal Trauma is one that's by a psychiatrist that goes into kind of the details of why we blame ourselves when we're a victim or an abuse survivor, why it becomes safer for us to think that we are to blame for our own abuse, and goes into how betrayal itself is a traumatic event. Self-care routines, and specifically creating self-care plans when flashbacks, panic attacks, or dissociation happens. That's like fundamental work that I do with all my clients before we go into processing their traumatic events. Because if you don't have the tools to be able to deal with the flashbacks and the dissociation and the panic attacks, then like we're not going to be able to really get there too far. I'll get to you in just a second. So what I'll kind of do with clients is be able to talk through a plan of like, what do you do normally when you experience a flashback or a panic attack, and how can we create a safety plan for you so that you know when you're experiencing this what the warning signs are, what to do when you're actually experiencing it, and how to take care of yourself before, during, and after any of those events. Yeah, go ahead.
What's disassociation? I'm just curious.
That's a great question. So for trauma survivors, there can be this process of physically leaving your body, and that's called dissociation. And in a lot of ways, what psychologists are kind of pointing to now is that we're all kind of dissociating in minimum ways throughout our day. So sometimes when we feel overwhelmed, we might want to just like play a stupid game on our phone. And that's like a form of dissociation in some way. It's whenever something feels completely overwhelmed and you start to kind of check out of yourself and your body. It becomes a little bit more intense for abuse survivors, where they can have experiences throughout the day where things are just too intense to be inside your own body, and you will literally feel like time will go by like that, and you'll come back into your body all of a sudden and be like, what was I doing for the last hour? Sometimes my clients will explain to me like, oh, I walked home, but I don't remember walking home. Anytime when you're feeling overwhelmed, basically, and it's a survival technique, basically, for you to be able to continue to go on when things feel overwhelming. That's my phone vibrating the microphone. So let's see here. And so that actually brings me to the next thing. So mindfulness meditations are often seen as like a good way to kind of combat specifically dissociation. I give a caveat that people push mindfulness a lot these days, and there is a point where it can be actually harmful to abuse survivors. Because if you're in a state where you're dissociating all the time, it means that your body's not ready for you to be back into your body. It means that you need to be able to have more space getting where you're not forcing yourself to be in your own body. And so looking at trauma-informed mindfulness exercises are really important so that you can be able to come back into your body at a slower pace, at a pace that is on track with your own healing process, so that you're not forcing something beyond what you're actually comfortable and ready for. Any questions about personal work? What time is it? Are we like done?
You have 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I didn't really go much into that, huh? You all see legal resources and you see the other resources. Do we have any quick questions about those before I maybe go on to answering that? No? No questions? I'm sorry about Jude.
No, he's totally fine. Okay. He's a baby.
Yeah,
he is. Whatever he does is perfect.
Thanks. Yeah.
It must come up with you.
Survivors as a counselor, do you advise those people?
Thank you for asking that. I did want to go into that.
I mean, it must be really confusing.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking that. I often have survivors who really want justice, and understandably so. And I give them the caveat that less than 1% of survivors get justice.
Really?
And the process of going through the courts, of collecting the rape kits, of doing the interviews multiple times with multiple strangers can be more re-traumatizing than it is healing. And so I recognize my bias as a therapist is like mental health healing. It's not really in the justice side of things, you know? And so I include these here because I think that it does become important for my clients who do want that. Like, here are some people who have said that they'll have a free first-time visit to be able to talk to you about what your rights are. And it's good for them to even know, like, what the process looks like in that. I wish that our justice system was built better. I wish that, like, LDS Family Services was built better. I wish that the church was built better. I wish a lot of these systems were built better, and they're not. And I think it becomes important to explain what the systems look like and then allow survivors to take that choice into their own hands. Because, and this is my biggest thing I'll say, is that like with any abuse or assault, it's not necessarily a sexual act. It's an abuse of power. It's taking away someone's choice. And so anything that I can do to help survivors have more choices, that's a part of the healing process. So if it becomes their choice that they want to pursue justice, then like, good for them, as long as it's an informed choice, that they can be aware of how it might be re-traumatized
throughout the process.
Yeah, that's another thing is that like the prevention process right now, I don't know how to prevent this, because as long as there's systems in place where people are in power, it's power abuse is what sexual abuse is and sexual assault is. I don't know how to get people to stop abusing their power. Maybe I should research that next. I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Yes. No, please. No. First. No, I think
I think first and foremost, since I'm a survivor of this, is number one, before you do anything, is to get it reported to law enforcement, period. There will be some justice in that, because you're not going to be the only abuse victim of this person.
Mm-hmm.
You're never the only one. So by reporting it, even if it's been 40 years, I don't care how long it's been, you report it to law enforcement, because you'll always find that they're either still doing it or there are several other victims. So you can get some sort of feeling by reporting it and get some justice, knowing that at least you've reported it to law enforcement. So there is a little bit of that.
Yeah, and I like what you say, too, about even if it's been 40 years, because I do think that sometimes people feel pressure to report it when they're not ready to even, like, admit that it happened in the first place. And so I think everything has to be done on your own timeline of what feels comfortable and what feels safe to you. And
you realize that it is a crime,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can forgive your perpetrator and all that, and that's great because it's a personal thing. But if you don't report it, you can be great and forgive, but they may go on and molest and assault other children. Mm-hmm. So that's why your responsibility is to report it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
Yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate it.
State of sexual abuse in the church today. So from my own experience, and feel free to come. I feel like I'll speak a lot more to this in my presentation tomorrow about my dissertation results. But I feel like what we're seeing now is a boom of not increased sexual abuse, but increased willingness of survivors to come forward and talk about their sexual abuse. And that's not to say that maybe there is an increase or maybe there's a decrease, but it's going to be impossible for us to really know that because the church doesn't collect data on the rates of sexual abuse within the church. We do know that Utah has the 8th highest state, out of the 50 states, is 8th in sexual abuse rates. And so there is like a higher rate of sexual abuse happening. And we can make some projections based off of that, that maybe there's more abuse going on within the church. And I think that it's safe to say that because there's systems of power, that there's going to be systems, that there's going to be people abusing their power. I didn't talk with sexual abuse survivors who were only perpetrated by other church members. So I talked with all sexual abuse survivors who happened to be LDS. And so there was a mix of perpetrators in and outside of the church. I did see different church leaders deal with it in very different ways that made it very possible for me to say, wow, church leaders don't really follow protocol when it comes to this stuff, and they're kind of flying by the seat of their pants. The things that are in place that maybe you all know about, but I'll review anyway, is that there is a hotline that bishops are supposed to call. A lot of people for a really long time thought that the hotline was kind of like a reporting hotline, similar to how you would report any kind of abuse to like CPS or DCFS. It turns out it's not. It goes to the church attorneys where they take data and report to bishops how to reduce the legal implications. So it became about being able to protect the church. I think that's probably one of the most damaging policies that are in place. And in my talking with sexual abuse survivors, they never talked to me about a hotline, but they also probably didn't know whether their bishop had called that hotline or not. Let's see. There was something else. Yeah, go ahead.
What do we know about cover-ups in the church? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, I've heard stories about the church paying out multi-million-dollar
settlements.
You know, what's true there?
What's true? I mean, I think that we had heard rumors for several years. Actually, a good friend of mine, Tressa Brown Edmonds, was the first person I knew of who was reporting, like, hey guys, this hotline isn't actually a hotline. It's a hotline for attorneys. And she, it hadn't officially been confirmed until Mormon WikiLeaks leaked a document that had that was specifically from the church attorneys that spoke to how they were handling different sexual abuse cases, which ones they knew of, and those were all hotline calls that had been made. So if you wanted to look at that document, you could kind of see some of the examples of the ways in which the church was dealing with these different sexual abuse cases. From some of my own survivors, I didn't hear as many of these like big high-level scandal cover-ups because I think that there's enough inbred shame about talking about sexual abuse that a lot of survivors didn't come forth in the first place. So that's my experience of having talked to survivors. There wasn't the big scandal that maybe we hear about more in the news. I think that the shame and not talking is far more commonplace than the big. Yeah.
Tim Kosoff seems to indicate that there were a fair number of out-of-court settlements with non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements, so people simply took the money and couldn't talk about it.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an interview with Cosmo and Dean Cole.
open on the couple pay.
Mm-hmm.
If you have nothing to do with it, you know, to be required.
Yeah.
Okay.
A spot for
pay. Oh,
okay.
Of course, I could do that.
Yeah. Any other? I think we're at time. But you know what? If you have any questions, I forgot to include my email. You can write it down if you'd like to. My current email address is amber@ let's see. I'm trying to debate. I'm about to phase out of emails. Okay. We'll do my Gmail address, which is amberwhiteley@gmail.com.
No dot?
No, at gmail.com.
No dot between your names?
No, not no dot between your names. And I'll also have my presentation tomorrow on my dissertation results. Feel free to come to that. It might get into some more of the deeper questions that you're asking about in terms of what I've seen through this research and talking with survivors. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.